Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Today we're celebrating Pollinator Week and a couple of guests to help us with that task. One, UW Extension horticulturist Lisa Johnson. She's horticulture educator for Dane County. And Lisa, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here.
And then joining us for the first time, Julie Hill, who is a horticulture outreach specialist for Walworth, Rock, and Jefferson counties. And Julie, good to see your face. Thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me, Larry.
So as we talk with them, I hope you'll join in with your questions. What do you want to know about creating a pollinator-friendly garden? You can give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And before we get going here, I do want to give a big thanks again to the gang in Bayfield for last week's show, live from the Bayfield Pavilion in Bayfield. Big crowd there, and thanks so much for the hospitality. One of the folks who was there, Donna, was from Washburn, and she came up to me after the show and said that when the Garden Talk theme music comes on, it's the only time her dog tries to sing to it. And yeah, well, anyway, there's Donna's dog singing to the Garden Talk themes show music. So, Donna, thanks for sending that along. I tell you what, we have a lot of fun on Garden Talk, and I always have a lot of fun when I'm in Bayfield. And it was great to hear Donna's dog sing along to that theme music. Well, Julie, what a welcome for you. This is your first visit to Garden Talk. Maybe give us a little about your background and what you do in your position.
Thanks, Larry. So, yes, I'm the horticulture outreach specialist for Walworth, Rock, and Jefferson counties, serving those residents that live in those counties. One part of my job is to answer questions, just like we're going to do here. So residents can email me, call me with their questions about things they're seeing in their yard, or if they need a plant identified, or if there's an insect that they're not familiar with. Any type of questions, indoor and outdoor gardening questions. And another part of my job is to give presentations for the public at general or in a public community area. So those presentations are about a variety of gardening topics as well.
Yeah. And Lisa, your position is quite probably a little pretty similar, but just for a different county.
Right. And we do have a horticulture helpline that's also staffed by Master Gardeners. So fortunately, I do have help getting all of those diagnostics questions answered. And Julie and I have collaborated with a number of other colleagues on Pollinator Week programming. So Pollinator Week is the 19th through the 25th. And we have got a whole bunch of online programs lined up. Julie, do you want to say anything about them?
Yeah, I would be happy to. So Wisconsin Celebrates Pollinator Week is a nod to a national effort of Pollinator Week that always happens the third week of June. That is an annual event that's managed by the Pollinator Partnership. And really, it's just to help spread the word about what we can do to protect pollinators. As Larry said earlier, our pollinators are declining, but there's lots of things that all of us can do, regardless of what size yard or no yard you might have, to kind of celebrate this week. This week in June, we are offering some free online programs in the forms of Zoom webinars, and there's lots of different topics happening every day between June 19th and June 23rd. A couple of them are about some new discoveries, some new research about bees that we're excited to share with everybody, and also about how you can do some pollinator-friendly gardening at home with maybe some trees and shrubs, or butterfly garden design that Lisa will be presenting. I'm also presenting one about making space for pollinators. So you don't need a lot of space. You don't need a lot of acreage to help pollinators out. So we want to just raise awareness, help educate everybody about all the things that you can do with whatever space you have or manage and the decisions that you make. So lots of exciting programs coming up there. And we also have some things that you can do. There's a scavenger hunt that you can do. We have the iNaturalist app with a BioBlitz. So you can go out and make observations of plants that you're seeing or maybe pollinators that you're seeing at work on those plants and record those in our iNaturalist BioBlitz. And then we also have a resource library. So if you're looking for all those great resources, and there's a ton out there, but we've distilled it down into our favorites and have narrowed that down to the top resources that you should be looking at. And that's on the website, too.
That's pretty cool. And the website again?
The website is going to be hort.extension.wisc.edu. From there, under the upcoming programs tab, you can find the Pollinator Week information.
Yeah, and we'll have that. I'm sure Jill's got that posted up on our page today. So ideas at wpr.org/Larry. Go to today's date, and we'll have that posted under today's date. So that's great. Steve in Boulder Junction has a question. Let's just go there. Hi, Steve.
Hi. I've got a lot of fruit trees, a lot of raspberry bushes, field of wildflowers, and it is full of bees. Whenever there's anything in bloom, there's bees out there. But I don't know what kind they are. They're small. They're not big like a bumblebee. They're little, and they don't bother me at all. I can be picking raspberries and pushing the bushes to the side, and they just seem to be oblivious to my presence. They're just there.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering if they're mason bees or some other kind of bee, or
wouldn't be a mason bee, I don't think, Lisa, because there's a lot of them and they tend not to be kind of that way, are they?
Not that I know of. I will say right out, I'm not an entomologist, but a lot of our Wisconsin bees are solitary and will live in ground tunnels. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them are, you know, small and quite docile. So it doesn't really surprise me that they aren't bothering you. We do have a really nice resource. I think it's at the Learning Store. Julie, correct me if I'm wrong, but the Wisconsin Bee Identification Guide. Mm. And it has, I mean, we have over, I think it's 400 or 500 bee species in Wisconsin. Trying to get them down, that would require our entomologist, PJ Leash. But we do have this really nice full-color publication that has some great pictures of a lot of the more common bee species. And you might be able to find it there.
Oh, that sounds great.
Just to add to that, Larry, it is available from our Extension Horticulture website, hort.extension.wisc.edu. If you use the search tool and type in Wisconsin bee identification, that guide will come right up. And there are about 500 different species of native bees in Wisconsin. So I'm glad to hear you have so many on your fruit trees there in your spot.
That's great. Steve, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Are they the biggest pollinators in our state, or should I say, which pollinators do the most work in Wisconsin?
Bees are the most efficient, and we certainly do have a lot of them, but we also have butterflies, beetles, flies, and a hummingbird species that are all different kinds of pollinators.
Our guests today, Lisa Johnson and Julie Hill, horticulture experts, and it's great to have them along. Questions for them, you can give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you could email us, email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. How do people get more involved in? Are there ways to get involved during Pollinator Week? I guess you were talking about some of them, Julie.
Yeah, so there are some online learning opportunities as well as just things you can do at home as far as maybe taking a look around and being a little observant about what's happening in your own area. Or if you go on a hike or on a or to a park or something and checking out the pollinators at work there. Lots of ways to do that. Also, you can check out our extension calendar of events that will pop up on our Pollinator Week website. There might be some local things happening, some local educational programming that's happening in your area that will be on that calendar that you can attend as well.
As you both were talking, I was thinking about my own little kind of pollinator garden because it sits between the sidewalk and the street.
Mm-hmm.
And it just kind of runs the length of the area there. And I've got pretty much all pollinator. And it's you see a lot of insect activity in that area, especially, well, right through the summer. And so you can do it in an area that's like 4 feet or 5 feet wide and, 20 feet long, maybe not even that.
Right. It's like Julie was saying, it's not necessarily that you have to have a huge space to do it in. Every little bit helps. You can even have pollinator gardens in containers. If you don't have in-ground garden space, you can have pollinator gardens on balconies or patios, window boxes. All you need to do is make sure that you're planting plants that are good for pollinators. And a lot of our native plants are.
Yeah. There you go. Jeff in Wauwatosa emailed to ask how he can keep his neighbor's raspberries out of his native plant garden. They are only separated by a picket fence. What can you do? I mean, raspberries like to move.
They do. Unless you want to use chemicals, which might not be advised if it's your neighbor's plant, there's not a whole lot that you can do about it other than to keep pulling them and, cutting the underground rhizome back as far as you can. Like you said, they do have these underground rhizomes, and they like to travel around. Unfortunately,
are those underground rhizomes? How deep do they go? I was thinking maybe you could put a barrier, underground barrier of 6 inches or so. Would that work?
Well, unfortunately, they go pretty deep. I think it might not hurt to do something like that. I just don't know that it would be super successful.
Worth the effort. Well, Jeff also said, by the way, that his lawn stays green in August when his neighbor's yards go brown. And he had, this was about 5 years ago, he planted micro clover, fescue, and a ryegrass mix. He says the few weeds he gets are easy to pull because the deep roots of the clover keep the ground moist and soft. Now he only mows every 2 or 3 weeks. Not for everyone, but he loves it.
That's nice. The clover is a great bee magnet, great pollinator support.
Megan in southeastern Wisconsin would like some advice for understory trees and shrubs that will work well under black walnut trees. Julie, any advice there? Kind of your area of the state.
And that's a tricky one because of the black walnut. Not everything is going to grow well under there. So if you're looking for some understory shrubs, Lisa might know off the top of her head, I would have to look at what plants might be a little bit more resistant or not as sensitive to that jug loan toxicity that comes from the black walnut.
Yeah, Lisa?
We do have a very nice fact sheet that is on the Wisconsin Horticulture site. If you just use your internet browser and put in Wisconsin Horticulture, and then once you get to the site, put in black walnut, that should come up, and it does have a number of plants that are susceptible and resistant. But a lot of our native plants are going to be more resistant to black walnut because they have evolved with it. So some of our understory plants, I'd have to double check on these, but some of the dogwoods like gray dogwood and American filbert. And if you were looking for trees, we've got musselwood. And there are, you know, a bunch of others that
would work. I think you're right on all those. I think they all can work under black walnut trees for sure. Bob in northern Wisconsin emailed that his dwarf sweet 16 apple tree he's had for 13 years has never bloomed, not even a hint of a blossom. His other dwarf apple trees of the same age always bloom, and he gets great apples from everything except the sweet 16. Now, he's in northern Wisconsin, so Julie, any thoughts on that? I mean, maybe he's out of his range or something?
I believe the Sweet 16 is a cold climate apple, so it should be good for that region. Not getting blossoms might be a physiology problem. I mean, it's interesting if it hasn't gotten blossoms at all. We also want to make sure we're maximizing light and air flow around the trees, but it sounds like he's experienced with apple trees.
Lisa,
I don't know if you want to jump in if there's any not getting blossoms.
The only thing I can think of, if the other trees of the same age are blossoming, is that it might be a problem with the flower buds of that particular variety not being hardy. You know, the leaf buds being hardy, but not the flower buds. It is, like you said, supposed to be a cold climate tree, but that does seem excessive.
You know, if the flower buds are getting damaged in a late snowfall or a late frost or something like that.
Yeah, although you'd think that if that was the problem, that the others would be too, unless it's separated from the others and in a area where the cold air drains down.
Area.
Yeah, lower, like a valley area.
It's a microclimate there.
Right.
That's another thing to think about, Bob. What's the location? Is it apart from the other trees, the other fruit trees?
And is it shaded?
Yeah, and is it shaded? That's the other thing. Lisa Johnson, horticulture educator for Dane County, one of our guests today. Julie Hills, the horticulture outreach specialist for Walworth, Rock, and Jefferson counties. Our guests, you can join in. Open lines get you on pretty quickly here at 1-800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau is our producer. A. Emily Ralph, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guests from UW Extension, our Lisa Johnson, horticulture educator, and Julie Hill, horticulture outreach specialist. And wonderful to have both of them with us. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Dave in Pikesville, we'll go to you now. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, I've been a beekeeper in Colorado for a number of years. I've now moved back to Wisconsin. I do have a pollinator area. I do have lots of flowers going, and I have fruit trees. Yet, to date, for the last 2 years, maybe three, I have not seen a honeybee in any of those areas. I have seen bees of bumblebees and other kinds, but not a single honeybee here. Can anybody comment on that?
So you're raising honeybees?
Not in Wisconsin, I'm not.
Okay.
I thought about doing it, but I have not seen a single bee here.
Yeah, there are very few, if any, feral honeybees in Wisconsin due to the varroa mite problems and colony collapse disorder and other things. So you're usually not going to see any honeybees unless somebody is raising them. They're not native to this country. They're European. Yeah. When I was a kid, I used to see them all the time, but the varroa mite really did a number on the honeybee in the 90s. And with between that and colony collapse, it's a little frightening because they do support a lot of our food crops, although we do have other bees as well that will do that work.
Dave, thank you for calling. Sean emailed to ask if the use of deer deterrent sprays like Liquid Fence or Deer Out negatively affect pollinators.
Wow.
It's a good question.
That's an excellent question.
I have no idea.
I don't either. Julie, I don't know whether you do.
I would have to look at what the active ingredient is in those products, and that would be a general recommendation for any product that you're using is what is the active ingredient, because there's a lot of different products, there's a lot of variety out there, and there's a lot of really good marketing out there that promote these products. And really what we need to look at is look at the label and see what the active ingredient is. And here is why I'm going to advocate for a little bit of research through our National Pesticide Information Center. And if you just Google that, National Pesticide Information Center, it's out of, I believe, Oregon, one of the universities in Oregon. And you can look up an ingredient and it will tell you the effects that it has in the environment and the other effects that it might have on wildlife. So I guess it depends on what the ingredient is and doing a little bit of research into what other problems that could cause. You know, it's possible that it might not, but would have to just know what's in there.
Yeah.
And could you give that site again or the name of the place to go?
It's NPIC, yes. Isn't it?
I think it's NPIC. It's National Pesticide Information Center. And it is just NPIC, NPIC.ORST.edu.
All right. There we go. Kay from Superior called to say her ornamental cherry tree has lots of flowers, but she hasn't seen any pollinators on the tree. She's near a golf course, but could that be a problem?
Oh, it could. I mean, they do use a lot of pesticides on golf courses. Everything from fungicides to I'm sure they do use insecticides because of the Japanese beetle problems. So, depending on what they're using, that could be an issue.
Yeah. Might check with a golf course. Some golf courses are advertising the fact that they're not using.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so there may be other reasons for the issue as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, there certainly could be.
Carrie in Turtle Lake, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey, good morning. I'm having a heck of a time growing lettuce both last year and this year. The first year I grew it in my raised bed 3 years ago, it was so abundant. And now just last year, I didn't have luck. This year, I can kind of tell it's not the same. I've changed the soil, so it's not the same soil from the first crops that I had. So I don't know if you have any suggestions.
And by soil, what did you replace the original with? Was it just black dirt or?
No, I buy big soil that usually has a fertilizer in it,
okay.
Not a topsoil, more of a potting soil, like a better grade.
Okay.
And is that the only type of soil that's in your raised bed?
Yes.
Okay. You might want to mix in some topsoil or some composted manure. Sometimes the problem with the potting mixes is that the top of the soil dries out so quickly, and also the texture is such that it's a little hard for seeds sometimes to get started. The other thing is, of course, how old are your seeds? What variety are they? How were they stored? I often have trouble myself with lettuce. It doesn't, the seeds don't last for very long. I don't know whether Julie has any other input.
Lettuce likes cooler weather too. Yep. So I'm just wondering if we, you know, had some high temperatures in May, that maybe that, you know, just impacted it negatively.
Yeah, could be. Lots of potential reasons there, Carrie, why it didn't work, but I'd maybe add a little.
I'd mix in some topsoil or composted manure. I tend to think that I have raised beds too, and I usually end up adding some of those other two ingredients just to make the soil a little bit heavier so that my seeds have a better chance because like Julie said, it was hot and it was dry, and it's entirely possible that the seeds had trouble with that.
Thanks, Gary. Appreciate it. Mark in La Crosse, on to you now. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Larry. Say, I've got two unrelated questions. One's about pear trees. 3 years ago, I planted a Parker pear and a Patton pear within about 15, 20 feet of one another on a slightly west-facing slope. One of those trees has flowered minimally the last 2 years. The other one hasn't flowered at all. And this year, neither one of them flowered. So I'm just wondering what I might be able to do to get some flower and some production there.
Hmm.
Yep. Where are you located again?
La Crosse.
La Crosse. Okay.
And how old were the trees?
Well, I've had them planted now for 3 years.
Sometimes it takes a while.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it takes several years, depending on the variety, but it could take 5-6 years before they're really flowering and producing.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, too.
Yeah, and it could be that they flowered the other years because the winter weather just happened to be ideal for them to do that. But Julie's right, for reliable quality flowering, it can take, you know, 5 to 7 years for a standard size tree, and at least 3 to 5 for a dwarf or semi dwarf tree. And it is possible that winter weather or an early spring frost might have impacted the flowers as well.
Mark, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Gary in Milwaukee, on to you now. Hi, Gary.
Oh, hello. So I think this pertains to pollinators, or at least pollination. I know that if I try to grow an apple tree from an apple seed, it's not likely I'll get the tree that I expect based on the tree the seed came from because of cross-pollination or whatever. I would like to try to grow sugar maples from a sugar maple seed or sugar maple seeds. And I'm wondering if I would, and also bur oak from a bur oak acorn. And I'm wondering if I would run into the same problem. Will I get the trees that I expect based on the parent? Will I actually get a sugar maple and a bur oak, or would I get some variation on those trees based on the way they're pollinated?
For the most part, unless there are like other oak species nearby or other maple species, you should. Both of those species are wind pollinated, but you should get the species that you started with.
Yeah, it's worth a try for sure.
Now, if you had a variety of sugar maple, that was a male tree, for example, then you wouldn't be getting seeds.
Yeah.
Although I have heard recently of somebody called me, his maple tree had reverted. Occasionally they will produce seeds. So that can happen.
Yeah. So I give it a shot, Gary. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Tim in Hollandale, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I work here in Madison. We have some concrete flower beds out in front of the place out here. Last year I found a swample, I don't know, seedling growing out of there, plucked it out of there, stuck it in a growing container, took it home, and over the winter I threw it in the garage, brought it back out this year, and it's actually still alive. So I want to plant that in my house out in the yard. How big does it have to be before I actually plant this thing? And is there anything I need to do prior to planting?
And how big is it now?
It's got four leaves on top, so, and it's probably only, I don't know, 8 inches tall.
You can go ahead and plant it in the ground now if you want to.
I put a fence around
that's
it.
That's exactly what I was going to say, Larry. Yeah, it's a good idea to protect little oak trees like that. We actually have a bunch of them that are about that size right now in the teaching garden. There's a program in Dane County called the Heritage Oaks program where we are inviting the public to use crowdsourced software to help us identify, locate, and measure oak trees that are older than 200 years. Those are called heritage oaks. And they've been on the landscape before Wisconsin was a state, before Dane County was a county. And we're trying to rescue some of those genetics by collecting acorns and growing them out. And then we'll be distributing those to the public once they get big enough. But we've got all little four-leafed oak seedlings coming up at the extension office. So.
And they're protected.
Yeah, I need to. I took off the fence on top because they were hitting the top of the fence. So now I need to make a larger fence so that the squirrels and so on don't get in there.
And I would just like to add, Larry, to be mindful of watering new trees.
Oh, absolutely.
Newly planted trees are going to need a lot of water, but also be aware of your soil. So if you have a really heavy clay soil, you might not need to water as much, but definitely getting that tree established is going to require a lot more water these next few years. So don't forget about it after you plant it.
And be mindful also of the taproot. It can be a little bit brittle, so you'll need to dig a deeper hole than you would for some seedlings. Oaks do have a pretty good taproot when they're young.
Yeah, I love those swamp white oaks.
They're beautiful.
They're absolutely beautiful. Just as an aside, you ought to check Bruce Allison's book on...
yes. Champion Trees.
Champion Trees. Mm-hmm. It'd be worth it to maybe locate some of those that are mentioned in his book and get some... nuts or whatever from those trees. Tim, thanks again for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in too. Well, I guess all of our lines are pretty much full right now. So let's go to Bruce in Kenosha County next. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Larry. I've got a stand of purple iris that has been the envy of the neighborhood. Even my neighbor had to go out and get some. She loved me so much. But mine aren't doing so well this year. They had a couple of blooms, and then now it looks like they're done blooming. What's going on?
Julie, will you want to take that one?
I probably will defer to Lisa because I don't have a lot of experience with iris. I'm
going
to guess that the weather probably had something to do with it, because we can blame it on that. But Lisa might have some more specific ideas.
Sure. If these are these bearded iris?
Yes.
Okay. So they can get crowded. That's one thing that can happen. So you might want to divide them. The other thing, unfortunately, that can happen is this nasty insect called the iris borer.
Yeah.
And it's the adult is a clear-winged moth, and what it'll do is it will lay an egg on the foliage, and then the little larva tunnels down into the iris rhizome and feeds. And while it's feeding, sometimes, unfortunately, soft rot gets in there. Which reeks, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
um, But you might want to dig up your iris and take a look. If you notice that some of the rhizomes seem squishy, or if you see kind of a light-colored line going down the leaf into the root, that could be an issue. So it could be any of those things. Overcrowding or iris borer, though, would be my
top of the
guess.
List. Okay, there you go, Bruce. Check that. He can check out and look for signs of the borer.
Yeah, you can look for the signs of the borer. You might not be able to totally do it without doing some digging, but if they've been in the same place for a long time, it's a big stand and they're crowded, it's probably a good idea to dig them up and divide them anyway. Ideally, we would want to do that in fall. Usually September is the best time to do that. However, if you do notice squishiness, or if you start to see the leaves, you know, turning yellow or pale green, then you might want to check earlier to see if there are, in fact, any iris borers in there. And we do have a fact sheet on that at the Wisconsin Horticulture website.
All right. There you go, Bruce. Thank you so much for calling. Danielle in Madison, we'll give you a chance. Hi.
Hi. My question is about an apple tree. About 9 years ago, I grew this tree out of a seed. It was a Macintosh apple. And like I said, it's about 9 years old. About 5 years ago, it started giving me flowers. And it gives me little tiny bits of apples, but it never an apple that's actual you can eat or good enough.
Yep.
Do you want to get that one, Julie, or do you want me to?
Well, my first reaction would probably be incomplete pollination on that one. That if you're getting flowers, but you're not really getting sizable fruit, that could be a problem. There's other things that also could affect fruits, like diseases or insects. But I also wonder if you're getting complete pollination, if there's another apple tree around that's helping to pollinate that one.
The other thing is the seed
yes.
itself.
Yeah, if you grew it from a seed, it is not likely to be a Macintosh apple. Apples don't come true from seed. They have to be vegetatively propagated, so that's why they're all grafted. So you may be getting anything.
Who
pretty
knows?
Much. Yeah. So it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, it doesn't look or taste like a Macintosh. But yeah. I think Julie has some good ideas about that as well.
Yeah. So that's one if you don't like the look of it.
Yeah.
You might just want to
taste or size.
Do a pruning cut right at the base.
Yeah. We call that basal pruning
basil
in the horticulture
pruning.
field.
There you go, Danielle. Thank you so much. Well, lots of calls coming in, but I guess there's a line open for you. Yeah, yes, there is. One line at 1-800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Lisa Johnson, horticulture educator for Dane County, one of our guests. The other, Julie Hill, horticulture outreach specialist for Walworth, Rock, and Jefferson counties. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at all kinds of things in the gardening area. We've zeroed a bit on pollinators. It's Pollinator Week coming up here, and Lisa Johnson and Julie Hill are Extension horticulture experts ready to answer any of your gardening questions for sure. Lisa, just before we go back to the phones, you have an event coming up, or do you not?
Yeah, a couple events. There is an event this weekend that is a community garden summit. Today is the last day to register for it. It's through the nonprofit Rooted. And there's going to be a bunch of educational presentations, jumping worms. There will be some ethnic cooking displays and sessions on that, some great Hmong recipes. We will have just a number of speakers. Composting is another
topic.
So it's a three-day event, and you can still register for that. And for Pollinator Week, Dane County Parks, I'm part of a team that is doing a couple of programs out at the Lucier Center. One of the nights is already full, but you can still do the other night, and those are free programs.
And you can find those on the Dane County website or what?
Yeah, the Rooted program, you do need to get a ticket for that, and that one is not free, but that's on rooted.org. And the other, if you just do a search for Dane County Parks and their programs listings, you
right
can.
Right there.
Yeah, you should be able to find it there.
Louise in Dodgeville, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi. I was actually weeding in our pocket prairie, and I came in at the tail end of the discussion about the heritage oaks and collecting acorns, and I was wondering if those small trees are for sale already, or and if so, I guess when and where to purchase one?
They are not ready yet, and I believe we will be, you know, either having them free or a nominal price for those. We probably need another season yet, but you can, if you'd like, you can contact me at the extension office. Or you can email through the Dane County Tree Board, and I'll get you on a list.
Yeah, there you go, Louise. Thanks for calling. Roger in Grantsburg, on to you. Hi, Roger.
Hi, Larry. How are you doing today?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I have a comment and a question. Actually, my question was answered by one of your previous callers. I had collected seeds from some apples that from up in Duluth, Minnesota, and they were just the best apples ever had. And I thought, oh, I'll try reseeding them. But now the question come back that it, or answer come back that they won't come out true to form or whatever, or taste like what I got. But my other comment, my apple tree that I've called and talked to you about before, finally got apples last year for the first time in about 12 years. Like, woohoo! Yay! Look at that! We got an apple. It was like I've been waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting, and all of a sudden, hey, that's an apple hanging on my tree! Wow!
Well, Roger, I'm glad you had the patience to wait.
Mm-hmm.
12 years is a long time to wait for an apple.
Yeah.
I imagine he ate a few along the way, though, over the 12 years while he was waiting for his own to start producing. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Oh, man. Karen in Harvard, Illinois. Hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you for having me. We have some hard-to-find bloodroot. It's a native in the woods.
Yep.
And it's going to seed now. And I understand you're not supposed to let them dry out. But we want to harvest them and be able to give them to others. So I was wondering if you had any advice how to save them without drying them out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Usually what happens in the wild is when the seeds are ripe, the pod will split and shed the seeds. And they're fairly heavy seeds, and they'll fall, you know, around the parent plant. And if you have the right kind of ant, they have a little structure that is attached to the seed called an elaiosome. And it's a kind of jelly-like structure that is attractive to ants. And the ants will haul the seed away and you know, bring it to their burrow, and they often will eat the elaiosome and then discard the seed somewhere else. And I must have the right kind of seed in my yard because I've actually had to do some family planning for my bloodroots and cut off their little seed heads before they it's almost become weed status in my yard. But I guess what I would do is, you know, keep watch on them. And then when you see that the pod is very full and about ready to split, I would then distribute those pods to people and have them open them and plant them right away.
Oh, put them in the ground right
away.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, that's kind of the easy way to do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You need to have your people lined up.
You need to have your people lined up. Now, the other thing that you could do is if you wanted to open the seed pod yourself and sprinkle the seeds on some moist soil, like in a pot, and keep it watered, that's another thing that you could try.
Yeah.
They seem to be pretty good at reproduction, at least in my yard.
There you go, Karen. Thank you very much for calling. Ken, you can join in, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Carol in Janesville has a question, I believe. Let's go there. Hi, Carol.
Hello. I just recently, sadly, lost a pagoda dogwood, and it had some sort of an orange fungus that I even noticed when I trimmed it in February.
Mm.
And I've had it taken down, and the fungus continues to work on the trunk, or not the trunk,
the stump. Mm-hmm.
You know, and I had someone here treating my ash tree, and he just told me to wash it all off and then cover it with dirt and mulch and stuff. But I have other dogwoods that have seeded themselves, and I'm concerned, is this going to be a problem for the dogwood?
It doesn't sound like the best advice to me, but I'm not the expert.
Julie, do you want that one or you want me to get it?
Go for it, Lisa.
So that is a disease called golden canker, and we do have a fact sheet on it at the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic site or the Wisconsin Horticulture site. And it is a fungus that is specific to dogwood, Cryptodiaporthe corni, and it is, unfortunately, as you have noted, eventually fatal. We don't really have a way to treat it other than pruning. When you see it on a dogwood, you should prune at least 6 inches below, and you should disinfect your shears after each cut. That's really the only way that we have of controlling it. Now, I actually don't think, you know, if you've got a stump that is cut real close to the ground, it's not a bad thing to go ahead and bury it. The only thing is you might start to get sprouts from the old dogwood coming up, and they would be susceptible to that fungus. It's probably still there in the system of the plant. Now, if you have other pagoda dogwoods, then it is definitely a concern. Other types of dogwoods don't seem to be as susceptible to that. I don't know for sure whether pagoda is the only one that it gets. I think it's dogwoods in general, but in particular, you see that on pagoda. I've never seen it on like a red twig dogwood or Cornus officinalis or Cornus moss.
I'd still be a little concerned if you have other pagoda dogwoods.
Yeah, I would definitely
nearby.
Be concerned about that.
So what do you do? I mean, if Carol's got something close by, a pagoda close by,
yeah.
Would you want to just... I worry about covering it, and then it just continues to live.
You could try and grind the stump out. That would probably be the best thing. but there's unfortunately like no drench or spray or anything like that that we really have other than pruning to control it. So trying to keep those other, if you have other pagodas, trying to keep them happy, making sure that you're watering during drought, making sure that they're thinned out so that there's good air circulation is pretty much the only thing you can do.
And I'd get rid of that stump.
Yeah, if you can, that'd be good. If you have that arborist there while he's treating your ash tree, maybe you could convince him to grind out that stump for you.
Yeah, that would be a very good thing to do. Carol, thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Peggy in Wauwatosa emailed a photo of her little red bud.
Aww.
Seated in the corner of her lot. She wonders if she can cut off the lower branch to make it less of a weeper, turn it more into a single trunk, and be less obtrusive to the neighbor's garage. So the branch is coming out and kind of, you know, creating a sight hazard. Could she do that?
I can't see the photo, so
yeah.
It's
just in general.
In general, yeah, you can limb up trees. You can certainly do that. I'm confused though by the description of a weeper.
She just wanted to. She didn't want it to be a weeper.
I see. Okay. Yeah, you can trim lower branches off, though.
I'd like to see it, though,
before I give advice.
Lisa Johnson and Julie Hill, our guests today. Lisa, horticulture educator for Dane County. Julie, horticulture outreach specialist for Walworth, Rock, and Jefferson counties. Our guest on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network, I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining in today. Lisa Johnson, one of our guests today, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. The other is Julie Hill, UW Extension Horticulture Outreach Specialist for Walworth, Rock, and Jefferson County. So, gardening questions, I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. And you had a comment about that photo. You were able to see the photo of the branch. Yeah.
Yes, the red bud. I hadn't looked at the email that was sent with the photo, but during the break I was able to look at it. And yeah, I wouldn't have any concerns about removing that particular branch. Yeah. It'd be ideal to do it during the dormant season, but as long as the leaves are fully expanded now, you could go ahead.
Okay. Chris in Sturgeon Bay. Hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. My question is there a source in Wisconsin for Vaccinium augustifolium? That's the low bush or the low wild blueberry that we have. I have been successfully growing some, but I would like to expand, and I'm looking for another source.
What I would do is go to the Wisconsin DNR website, and in the search bar, I'd put in native plant sources or native plant vendors. They have like a 28-page resource that gives all kinds of native plant suppliers. And I think they keep it pretty well updated, but there's everything from prairie plants to woodland plants to trees and shrubs.
And probably wild blueberries.
Well, that's my hope.
Yeah, that makes good sense. Give that a shot, Chris. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Stacy in Monona, your turn. Hi, Stacy.
Hi, this is actually Casey.
Oh, Casey, okay.
I'm following up on the redbud question. I always grow eastern redbuds because a long time ago that was recommended for me. And they bloom and they're beautiful and they have seed pods. And I try to transplant the seed pods. Never works. They grow where they are sent somehow and decide to grow from where the wind takes them in our yard. So I don't know what the difference is that they're successful and I'm not. Second of all, these I would like to move and transplant. Could I get some information on how long and how tall they should be before I do that?
Julie, do you want that or you want me to get it?
Go ahead, Julie says.
Okay. We can't see each other, so that's why we're doing this awkward thing here. All right, so as far as growing them from seed, first of all, I do have a book in my office by Michael Durr that is on plant propagation of woody species. Now, I'd have to double-check this information with that, but what I would do, and I'm not sure how you did it, but I would wait for the seed pods to mature and turn brown, and then harvest the seed. And I would keep it cold over the winter and then transplant it in the spring. Now, it may be a species that needs a moist stratification. So, like, you put it in a plastic bag with some, I guess I'd mix probably some potting soil with some topsoil. And that's a cold, wet treatment. I mean, not wet, but moist. Mm. And so often a lot of these species are going to need that kind of thing, which would mimic what would be going on during winter.
Yeah.
So I would try that. If that's what you did and it didn't work, then get a hold of me at the Dane County Extension office, and I will look that up in Michael Durr's book. It's a wonderful book.
Yeah,
I mean,
it tells
how to, like, from pine cones, from cuttings, whether you take softwood or hardwood cuttings, and it also addresses seeds. Yeah, yeah. And if you're going to do it from cuttings, generally you're going to need some kind of rooting hormone, and he talks about what strength solution and all kinds of things.
If you type in Michael Durr, too, you may be interested in even a copy of the book. And
yeah.
I can't remember, how's Durr spelled?
It's D-I-R-R, and the other author is Charles, and I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name, H-E-U-S-E-R. But it's called something like The Manual of Woody Plant Propagation.
Yep, good one. Stacy, good luck with that. Thank you for calling. Christina in Glenwood, thank you for calling.
Hi there, thank you. I'm wondering if I can safely trim tree limbs and suckers from deciduous trees, particularly in ash and flowering crabs.
At this time of year?
Yes.
You can do flowering crab and ash. I would not do because of the emerald ash borer. I'm not sure whether they, like some other species, are attracted to fresh cuts, but I would do the ash during the dormant season. But the crab apple you should be able to do now.
And Christina, thank you for calling. Jim in Stevens Point has many crab apples with prolific blossoms this spring, but one particular crab, the latest bloomer, looks like it won't have any apples. The flowers ended up dried and brown, unlike years before. So he wonders if maybe that little heat wave caused this look, or maybe it was it something else. So the flowers just all turned brown.
Hmm.
That's a tough one to figure out, Julie.
Hard to say for sure. You know, just from the description, definitely there could have been some damage either from a late, you know, our late winter, we had a really extended winter, or from the heat wave we had in May, that definitely could have caused damage. I would keep an eye on it next year and see what happens. Be really observant.
Yeah.
Yeah, also do check the branches for any signs of fire blight. So sunken, discolored cankers, stuff that looks like sticky sap. That's a possibility, too. But I think Julie's ideas about the late frost or the heat. We did actually a couple of years ago. I remember we had like lilacs and crabs, flowers changing colors because of the heat. So
and blooming at weird times.
Yeah,
second blooms on them as well.
Yep.
A lot of that a couple of years ago. Linda in Williams Bay. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, I've tried a variety of things to protect my zucchini from the bugs that lay the eggs on the stem and then just gut them. Tin foil, I've tried observing when the insects are out and cleaning the leaves. I haven't had very good luck with any techniques. Do you have suggestions?
How big a plant, a pot or a patch do you have?
No, it's just small, just three plants on a hill.
Okay. I was just thinking maybe cover them.
Yeah, well, I'd say early in the season, you can certainly use floating row cover. You do, of course, once they start to flower, unfortunately, have to uncover them so that the pollinators can get to them, unless you want to do the pollinating yourself. And you certainly could move the pollen from the male to the female flowers once female flowers start to be produced. But, yeah, the squash vine borer is a pain. We do also have a fact sheet on that one at the Wisconsin horticulture site that you can take a look at. Not a whole lot that you can do in terms of timing. Maybe plant them a little bit later, but I tend to think the floating row cover might help at least a little bit since you've tried other things. Also, something like neem oil. Of course, you have to, use that fairly often. And I think the fact sheet talks about some other organic products.
Ways to do it.
Yeah.
All right. Let's see. Marilyn in South Range. On to you. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi. We live kind of in the middle of a hayfield. I have four or five different raised beds for tomato plants and also perennials that I don't know what to do with, so I've put one of the things in there. And around the edge, we always get grass and other perennial weeds like dandelions and stuff. First of all, can I take Roundup and kind of go around the edge outside? Not inside. Then I hand pick it and dig down and everything. But on the outside of the raised beds, and be very careful that you're not getting on the plants. But is that safe for the vegetables?
No, Julie, do you have any comment on that?
I would be really hesitant to recommend doing that, especially in the summer. I guess if you're doing some really targeted treatments, but another non-toxic method you could use, because as we know, Roundup, anything that it touches, it's going to kill, or anything that comes in contact, it can be really harmful, especially as we're talking about pollinators here and other beneficial insects. Another non-toxic method you could do is just do smothering. You could maybe put a border of like a black plastic or even cardboard down around those beds and smother those weeds out and smother that grass out and just leave it there. And that will do a really easy job of just smothering it. And it's a non-toxic method.
Yeah, it's probably certainly the safer approach for sure. Yeah. Thanks for that question. You can join in, too, 800-642-1234. Dixie in New Auburn wonders if there's native pollinator plants that are suitable to plant on top of a septic mound. She's concerned about roots going down and negatively impacting the septic system, but would love to cover the mound with native wildflowers for pollinators. And my own experience with this, I believe, is that, yes, indeed, you can. But Julie, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, I would agree that, yes, you can. It just, this is where I always advocate for people to do research before they plant, because there are certainly perennial, native perennial plants that really do have extensive and deep root systems. But I believe there are other things that you could plant. And I have seen some resources on this, too, about how to plant over a septic area appropriately. I would just be careful, you know, with your choices, but doing some research to really look at how deep those roots might go. I don't have any specific recommendations. I don't know if Lisa does about what to plant, but definitely I think there's something you could do.
I think the native plant nurseries, some of the websites, Neil DeBoll's website, for example, I think has some specific recommendations regarding that. Prairie Nursery, and probably the other nurseries do as well, because I'm convinced that you can grow them. Alan in Kenosha, your turn. Hi, Alan.
Hey, how you doing, Larry? I just wanted to comment. You know, we've got this problem with pollinators, and we not just pollinators, but insects in general. And we've seen a decline across the world in insects. And, you know, the insects are not being killed by Roundup. From all the research, including bear research, which makes most of the pyrethrins you know, things that are made like pyrethrins, but are made by in the lab, are the reason that we see such declines in these stocks. It's not Carbaryl. It's not the Roundup. It's the pyrethrins, and we see this happening in Europe too, where Carbaryl and where the chemicals that are affecting nervous systems have been banned because they are extremely toxic to humans. Pyrethrins, on the other hand, are not necessarily toxic to humans, but they're very toxic to insects. And we need to put the emphasis on the control of pyrethrins if we're going to do anything about our pollinators.
Well, comments from Lisa, do you want to comment on that?
Sure. Yeah, it is true that pyrethrins have been used a lot because they are non-toxic, or not non-toxic, much lower risk products to, you know, humans and things like birds. But a large part of what's happening to insects around the world is not just due to insecticides. It's due to habitat loss, habitat fragmentation. Certainly the insecticides are an issue as well, but there's also diseases such as colony collapse and so on. So it is a very complex problem, and the caller is right that we are seeing it worldwide. I would also say that climate change is probably affecting a lot of insects as well.
Alan, thanks again for the comments. Kate in Pigeon Falls emailed to say she has a male and female winterberry that don't produce many berries. She's heard that some varieties are more successful than others in northern Wisconsin. Neither of you are working in northern Wisconsin, but Julie, any comment on that?
I'm not familiar with the different varieties of winterberry. Are you sure that you have both male and female plants, because you do need both to produce the berries? I don't know if it's a regional problem because you are more north. Lisa might have some ideas on the different varieties.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are specific male pollinators that are recommended for certain female varieties. And I think that the winterberry holly, I'm trying to remember whether it's a zone 4 plant or whether it's a zone 3 plant, but you may not have the right male pollinator for the particular female.
So you have to look that up.
Yeah, you have to look that up.
Yeah, that would be, but that should be easy enough to find.
Yeah, there are lists, and it might even be in one of Michael Durr's books, although, you know, they do have new male cultivars coming out.
Yeah.
But I know that there are some that are recommended for certain cultivars of the females and others not.
Just have two more email questions that are maybe a comment and a question that we haven't gotten to yet on the show that I want to make sure we get to as well. Chris called to suggest winter sowing for growing redbud trees. And winter sowing,
that might work, yeah, as well.
That gives that
vernalization that I was talking about with the cold stratification.
And Bill emailed that he has winter die-off on 2 globe boxwood, and he wonders, can he just cut out the dead branches?
Yes, you can. I mean, they're not going to come back. I would certainly give them a while, at least till the end of June, to see if you see any new growth coming. The thing with, I'm sorry, you said they were arborvitae or boxwood?
Boxwood.
Okay. They do have, both of those actually do have some latent buds that are a little bit farther back. But if you don't see anything coming by the end of June, then, yeah, take it out. It's not going to come back. Now, one thing I would be concerned about is that it might actually be boxwood blight instead of winter kill.
Yeah.
So if you see that continuing, especially with spots, you might want to get a sample into Brian Huddleston at the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic.
That's a very good piece of advice.
Usually if there aren't spots, if it's like a total drying out, you know, without any spots, then it's usually winter related.
Julie, we have we've answered a lot of questions here on the show today. Are these common questions for you? What are the questions you're getting right now?
Oh, I'm getting a variety. There's no theme. It's a lot of different ones about a variety of plants and a variety of problems. So they are really all over the board, just like here.
Are you having the spongy moth questions that you had last year?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Definitely. Spongy moths are, unfortunately, a big problem again this year because of how dry it's been.
Yeah.
If I could just make one comment about the previous commentary about the herbicides and the insecticides. Herbicides, while yes, they might not have a direct impact on insects or pollinators, there are indirect impacts. And herbicides have other ingredients called surfactants and other things that can harm our insects. And we're also, you know, finding out how complex the issue is, like Lisa mentioned, that things like fungicides mm-hmm. and herbicides can yep. contaminate the pollen and the nectar and things like that. So they're
good
not
points.
Off the hook. They're not off the hook. All I wanted to say is that, yeah. you know, it is a complex issue and we need to do our due diligence to look up ingredients, do our research before we use and buy and apply any products.
Lisa, Julie, thank you both very much for being with us. Lisa Johnson, horticulture educator for Dane County, and Julie Hill, horticulture outreach specialist for Walworth, Rock, and Jefferson counties. Well, thanks to them, tech expert Beth D'Angelo will join us on Monday to answer your tech questions. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend and stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.